All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck Knicks? What the fuck sticks? What the fuck stirs? What the fuck Adelphians? That just came in. I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. Welcome. Welcome to the show. How are you? We have three shows this week. We're going to have three shows this week. We're packing them in. Today, Claire Danes is in the garage. Claire Danes is a fan of the show, wanted to do the show, had no idea, came out of nowhere, and I'm thinking, Claire Danes? Hell yes, I want to talk to Claire Danes. She seems to hold a fairly prominent position in my unconscious and conscious somewhere along the line. I remember when Claire Danes was everywhere, and I'm like, who is that woman, that Claire Danes person? She seems intense, and then you'd see her in movies. You're like, holy shit, she's a great actress. Then all of a sudden, she went back to college, and I'm like, what is that about? That seems like a good idea. I was thrilled that she wanted to do the show. So she's here. And by the way, thank you for watching my season two of Maron. I appreciate it. I'm glad you liked it. I was very happy with the finale. I don't want to spoil it for anybody if you haven't seen it. It's got Eddie Pepitone and Dave Anthony and Andy Kindler. And I don't want to tell you, Ted Lang is in it. Peter Berman, the comic. It's interesting, the story about Peter Berman. Peter Berman is a comedian. He owns a pet store right up the street from me. I was told by another comic, and I support his business. It's called Rock Dog and Cats right up there on Colorado. So that backstory is relatively true. He's a very sweet guy. I don't think he's as bitter as the character he played, but it's sort of funny how art imitates life, if you're going to call my show art. But I wanted to make sure that you knew that we shot in his pet store. That's an interesting backstory. There are more backstories. Perhaps I'll do more of those. And we're still waiting on a pickup. So I'll let you know when that happens. I was away for 4 days. I spent some time in San Francisco doing fun things. I did an experiment in having a good time and enjoying myself. I spent some time with a person who lives in another state, and we got together and we hung out for like 4 or 5 days, and we had a great time. We saw movies, we ate good food, we did tourist things, we did all the things you do in San Francisco, and had a lovely time. And now the vacation is over and I'm full of heartache and anxiety. I just tend to make life more difficult for myself, and I don't think I have a great way of looking at everything. And I think at some point I got to take action, because I'm getting tired of myself. Well, I've been reading this book. It's a great companion, I might add, to another book that God knows some of you have heard me talk about, Ad Infinitum, The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. And then my psychologist, who I see erratically, started dropping the title of this book, The Fantasy Bond, Structure of Psychological Defenses. What it's about, I used to do this line saying that, you know, anyone's personality is just a very elaborate defense mechanism. It's just a reaction to the first no or the first detachment. And I'm happy to find that as I read this book by this Robert W. Firestone, which was written in 1987, is that I'm not that far off. I know some of you tough love motherfuckers are like, you know, shut up, quit whining, and pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But some of us are more pensive. Some of us are more thoughtful. Some of us are more compulsive about the inner work. The fact that I don't have a significant other in my life or dependents or anything else, you know, my problems are my children. And there's some part of me that wants to understand deeply, or at least get some context for the emotional experience I'm having as a grown-ass man who is relatively incapacitated emotionally, clearly. And the fantasy bond is about, if you have emotionally detached parents or emotionally needy parents or parents that were incapable of providing you the space to sort of develop into your own person with the support that's required of parents, what you do is you sublimate that or shove that shit down and then create this fantasy idea of how good your parents are. So that's the fantasy bond, is that the emotional content of what parents are supposed to be may be absent, but because they're your parents and because of all the input you're getting from the world, you know, you got to love your parents and they're good parents. So all that stuff, all that doubt and all their neediness and all their sort of emotional drainage and molestation, emotional molestation, boundarylessness, is just sublimated, and that becomes your inner life. That becomes your emotional life that is unruly and certainly self-flagellating, self-critical, insecure, not complete, But on the outside, you're holding on to this idea that these people are, you know, your parents. And that goes on for a while. But his whole, I think his angle is that you bring this fantasy bond into the rest of your life for the rest of your life if you're emotionally structured that way. And obviously, everybody has an idealism that goes into relationship. But it really goes into this whole idea of, what is the difference between love and need? And these are ideas I've had in my fucking stand-up for 20 years. And being the self-centered person I am to a certain degree, I'm flattered that I was thinking along the lines that, you know, this guy thought were relatively important enough to build a whole book around. And it's shedding some light. But the one thing that saddens me is that I read this stuff and it's sort of like, hey, yeah, this is it. This is it. I got it. Now what? The one thing I can say about the tough love crowd, the think positive crowd, the pull yourself up by your bootstraps crowd, is that that might be, at the end of the day, the only real option you have in some form or another. You know, the idea that you're going to get back down to the core of it all and rewire it, you know, after 50 years or 40 years or 20 years even of life, is probably a long shot. So you have to act against your instincts and, you know, kind of hyper-assess, every sort of interaction that seems volatile or destructive or disingenuous, and live your life like that. Hypervigilant. I'm not saying frightened, but hypervigilant. And that's exhausting. I went into City Lights Bookstore, and as some of you know, I did my time at the front of political talk for the lefties back in the day when the Bush regime was in place. And my brain was in that. That was a good way to sort of, kind of funnel my anger, you know, to redirect it from me onto the world. So I bought a book. I'm going through City Lights. And this always happens at City Lights. There's a sort of importance to it. City Lights is where Allen Ginsberg first read out loud Howl, sitting there in the early 60s, changing the world, creating a poetry that had never been heard. The Beatniks came through there. Ferlinghetti owned it. It's got a history to it. It's weighty. It's amazing. It's a place you're supposed to go in and go, it's all here, man. It all happened here. It's a place where I go in and I look at the books that they're publishing, and there's always a book there that's sort of like, yeah, I got to get back on track. I got to reconnect with the real issues of the world. So I see this book just sitting there, just the right size. It's called The Violence of Organized Forgetting. And the subtitle is Thinking Beyond America's Disimagination Machine. And I'm like, holy fuck, those are some words that you don't usually see together. And the poetry of it is resonating with me. It's got to be a portal into all the issues. It's got to be a portal into a frame of mind that dissects and understands the culture we're living in as it spirals down the drain because of classism and complete narcissistic modes of existence. So I'm like, holy shit, man, I'm going to get this book. I'm going to read it. I'm going to rejigger my brain and understand it all. Yeah, so I'm doing that. And, I don't know. I'm a relatively civic-minded person, but I don't know if I can go to the front lines to guarantee that democracy stays alive and functions for everyone. I have a certain amount of faith, but I think that faith may be a tremendous rationalization. Not unlike a lot of faith, probably. We got to talk about the patent troll situation for a minute. There's some news. There's some news about the patent troll, and it affects all of us. If you've been listening to the show for a little while, you know the threat we've been under from the patent troll. All right? Not just WTF, but all podcasters. A lot of us got these shakedown letters that said, claimed we were infringing on a license. They said that we owed them a fee. They would not be clear on what the fee was. I would not engage with them because I thought there was a problem. If you're not going to tell us what the fee is and you're not a legit upfront business, if you're just looking to extort money. So they terrorized a lot of podcasters, and they actually sued the How It Works podcast and Adam Carolla. Now, as part of an effort to beat this troll and protect what we do for a living, Adam Carolla came on this show and we asked you to donate to his legal defense fund. And he did. And his listeners did. And listeners of other shows did, to the tune of more than $450,000. Because just as a little guy, which Adam is, despite what anyone may think, you know, in terms of the business world, in terms of podcasting, Adam's in the fight. He's been sued and he's fighting.
And apparently that scared the troll shitless, and now they're panicking. And a panicking troll can be dangerous as well. Okay, so hear me out, and maybe we can beat this thing once and for all. Last week, you may have seen some news articles about the troll, personal audio. That's because the troll suddenly sent out a press release out of nowhere. Now, as with most things having to do with this troll, a lot of what they're saying is total bullshit, but let me read you some of what they said. And I'm quoting here from their press release. Quote, Personal Audio, the pioneers in personalized media solutions, this month offered to dismiss Adam Carolla from its highly publicized patent infringement lawsuit, unquote. Now, hold on right there. What it doesn't say is that they want to have the lawsuit dismissed without prejudice. Without prejudice. That just means that they stop what they're doing right now. But they can refile the lawsuit at any time in the future. They're not actually dropping the lawsuit. That's bullshit. And why are they not dropping the suit entirely? Okay, let's read on. Quote, when Personal Audio first began its litigation, it was under the impression that Carolla, as well as certain other podcasters, were making significant money from infringing Personal Audio's patents. After the parties completed discovery, however, it became clear this was not the case, unquote. Okay. So in other words, they tried to shake us all down and we all called their bluff. And now that they realize they're not going to get any money out of any of us and that we're going to fight back, they're acting like it was all a big misunderstanding. But, and here's the important part, the but, they're still not dropping the suit. Why? If they say podcasters aren't worth it, why don't they just drop the suit entirely? Simple. They're giving themselves the option to refile it again at any time. All right. Now, here's this is now look at how they frame Carolla. All right. Now they go on to complain about the money that was raised for the Legal Defense Fund. Quote, Adam Carolla is asking people to donate money to him for a lawsuit that he no longer needs to defend. Getting his fan base to continue to donate to his legal fund is a cynical exploitation of the publicity power he enjoys as an entertainer, unquote. So if that's how they feel, then just drop the whole fucking lawsuit. If they're so concerned about the fundraising, why not just drop the lawsuit entirely? Then all the fundraising will stop because they don't want to drop the suit. They want to be able to bring it back at a later date. Unless the suit is completely dropped, they will always have the option of coming back and doing this all over again. Whenever they want, hey, maybe podcasters are doing better. Let's try and shake those little fuckers down for some money. Here's my point, folks. These guys are clearly on the ropes, and they're on the ropes because podcasters and podcast listeners stood up for themselves and refused to be bullied. I know that I wasn't going to let these guys shake me down. There was no fucking way. We need to make this so difficult for them that they have no choice but to drop the case entirely. Now, listen, we've already asked for a lot from you. You've written letters, you've signed petitions, and you've donated your hard-earned money, so we're not going to ask you to do any of that again, all right? What we will ask you to do is shop. Whenever you need to shop online, use the Shop on Amazon banner that's on the homepage of WTFpod.com. There's a banner on Adam's site as well. In fact, go click the banner now and just bookmark the link. Anytime you shop on Amazon using that link, a portion of your purchase will go toward the defense fund, which means we keep showing the troll that we'll fight this thing until they go away for good. It doesn't cost you any extra money. It's just regular Amazon shopping. It's an easy way to keep this thing going strong. These guys are gangsters. This is their business. Shaking down the little guy. It is not right. It's not morally right. It's not judicially right. It's not right. They're working a loophole. And this is their business. And they fucked with the wrong little guys. If they want to go fuck with other people, because now they're turning their focus onto TV networks. They're just hoping for a payout. Oh, let's just pay these guys out so they don't bother us. And that's how these guys stay in business. Fuck them. So I'm just trying to encourage you to keep aware of this, that this is ongoing. I know a lot of it's gone off the front burner. And a lot of podcasters are like, oh, is that still a thing? Yeah, it's still a fucking thing. And in the future, it could be a worse thing until we shut this fucker down. So help out if you can. I appreciate it. All right, so there you go. I did it. I talked about something that matters. Now let's talk to Claire Dane. Sometimes I wish I paid more attention in school, or in some cases, any attention at all. There are probably a lot of things I could have gotten more out of, like literature, and now it's probably not in the cards to go back to school and study the classics. But luckily for us, there's a new podcast called The Foxed Page that dives deep into the best books of all time. This is basically like the best possible college English class, but more relaxed and fun. No pressure of grades or needing to prepare something to say in class. It's only the books you want to read and know about, presented by best-selling author Kimberly Ford. Everything from Cormac McCarthy to Madame Bovary, from classics like Frankenstein to modern hits like Lessons in Chemistry. I love Ireland, but I missed the boat on James Joyce. The Foxed Page has a three-part series on Dubliners, and that's a pretty great starting point. Want to get the most out of what you read? The Foxed Page is for you. Get it now wherever you get your podcasts. Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? Well, for me, honestly, it's my stereo system. For years, I've wanted this stereo system, and then at some point, I realized, like, hey, you're saving money, buy it. So I got a pretty top-of-the-line, tube-driven stereo system. It has changed my life. It's not only great for listening to music, it's great for me to sit there with my guitar while I jam or just rock out. Because when we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. Just like the all-new Lexus GX. It has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Available dynamic sky panorama glass roof. Available front row massaging seats. Available 33-inch all-terrain tires. And available multi-terrain select system for off-road driving. Ability. Any of these options will help you take your Lexus GX to the limit, just like I did with my stereo system. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Claire Danes is in my garage.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. I'm a little beside myself.
I'm
here.
So giddy. I am giddy.
You are.
I really am.
I am too, a little bit. We're gonna have to work through it together.
Okay.
Why am I giddy?
I don't know. It's a contact high.
It is.
Yeah.
Like, because you're one of those people, I don't know, some people I'm like, I feel familiarity.
Yeah.
I feel like I...
Well, same here, but in my imagination, because I hear you.
You know me, though. If you listen.
Yeah, I know you. I mean, in a way, in one... Yeah.
I don't know you. I know the stuff you do. It's all amazing. I was watching, like,
It's not all amazing.
It was pretty amazing.
Well, thank you.
I mean, I've been watching Homeland. I got into it.
Okay.
Because I don't watch anything. But right. Then, like, yeah, I heard that you wanted to come on the show. And I'm like, well, I know this is an amazing show, so now I got to watch all of it.
Yeah.
So I've watched it. So I'm very familiar now with how insane you can be.
Yes.
As a character.
As a character. Yes.
Is it not in real life?
I wouldn't characterize myself as insane.
No, but I mean that. Well, you mean the character or you?
Well, the character is formally, yeah, clinically,
right,
bananas. But no, I think I myself have worked very hard to achieve some kind of balance and uh-huh, structure and order, and uh-huh, I don't think I'm.
But it did require work.
Yeah, a lot of work. But the work that I most enjoy doing. I for a long time I thought I was going to be like a therapist. So this is ideal because I get to merge my two passions.
Being an actress is ideal.
Yeah, I mean, I always wanted to be an actress for reasons that were totally inexplicable, but
because
totally
you're a kid.
True. Because I was but not every kid wants to be an actor. No. But then somebody told me when I was around, I don't know, nine, that most actors don't typically make that much money. So I reevaluated, and I was
gonna
at nine, and I was going to be a therapist, yeah, and do acting workshops on the side. I was going to live next door to my best friend, and we, yeah, were going to have one pool with two slides in our respective yards that would go into, you know, and, yeah, I had it all worked out
at nine.
Yeah. And this was the plan for a solid year. And then one day I actually made a formal announcement at the dinner table, and I said, you know, to my parents and brother,
yeah,
money or no money, I was gonna have to be true to my art, and I was going to be
true to your art,
an actor. Yeah, and then kind of was, but so this was always plan B, was being a therapist. But it just so happened that I now have a career in exploring what it is to be crazy, well, within the context of acting.
Right, a supportive context.
Yeah,
a low risk context.
A very, very low risk context.
But you're very good at it.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's very compelling.
Yes, and turns out that my best friend, the same one who I was going to live next door to, is in fact a therapist.
No.
Yeah.
Was that even her plan?
No.
She stole your idea.
She's a thief.
And now, are you still friends?
Yeah, besties.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
From age 9?
From age 9.
All right, let's go back, because like I had a question. Like, I remember when you sort of went to college. I remember culturally.
I sort of went to college. It's true.
Well, I remember culturally, there was like, you know, Claire Danes is going to college.
Right.
And I was very impressed with that. I'm like, good for her.
Thanks.
Who knows if this acting thing's going to pan out.
Yeah.
But before that, where do you come from? Do you come from a perfect land?
Obviously. No, I do not come from a perfect land. I come from Crosby Street. I grew up in...
Oh, right in Manhattan?
In Soho, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, my parents were artists, and
both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, yeah. You and Lena Dunham.
Yeah, well, we grew up in the same neighborhood, but I'm
a little
older.
But you're not old at all.
I'm pretty old. I'm 35.
35 is nothing.
Well,
have you looked at your resume? You're 35.
I'm 35.
I thought, like, I feel like I've been seeing you for my entire life.
Well. Yeah, I mean, I've been doing it since I was 12, so...
Was it 12?
12 was when I got an agent.
Was 12 this so-called life?
13, I did the pilot of my so-called life. And then it didn't get picked up, and then it did, a half a year later.
So what kind of artists?
They met at Rhode Island School of Design.
RISD.
My mom...
Were they groovy?
Yeah.
Cutting edge?
They're great. They're totally idiosyncratic people. But my mom was a textile designer for 10 years, and my dad was a photographer. And then they had two kids and decided to, you know.
No more art?
Well, their trajectory is interesting. So my mom ran a toddler school in our loft. Six kids in the morning, one or two year olds in the afternoon.
She just figured she had kids. Why not bring some more kids in?
No, she was always interested in art and early childhood development and education. And she was an art teacher for a while and out of school. And so she always had that interest. And she was the eldest of five kids. And so she was, when she was five, her mom, my grandmother, then had four other kids in very quick succession, like a year apart. So she kind of became her assistant by default.
Five kids?
Yeah.
Is it a Catholic thing or just
a
thing?
No, it wasn't a Catholic thing.
Just wanted to have them?
They're Protestant. They were just into it.
So you have like all these aunts?
I have two aunts from that side and yes, and two uncles.
That's a lot. A lot of cousins.
Yeah. I mean, you'd think I'd have more, but...
Maybe the experience of being one of five was enough to curtail some of their desires to have children.
Maybe. So my mom did that. Actually, Lena, when I'm friends with Lena, when I first met her some time ago, she said that her mom was to... her mom wanted my mom to know that she was still upset that Lena had not been accepted into the school because she had.
Oh my God. Is that true?
It's true. There wasn't room, but it was not personal. And,
it was just a space thing.
It was a space thing.
It was not some sort of weird envy, sort of like they're still artists. We gave it up.
Oh gosh, I don't think so. No,
we're familiar with those Dunhams.
I don't think so.
Yeah, they think they're the best artists on the block.
Yeah, yeah.
So you didn't grow up around the school thing. That was not happening.
No, well, I was four. I was too old at that point. No, I don't think I would have gone anyway. Conflict of interest. But I grew up kind of looking after these kids myself because they were in my space and They were there before I left for school and were there well after.
Well, that's what I mean.
Back.
You were
so
in
I know
the house.
A lot of nursery rhymes. Yeah, a lot. Yeah.
And your dad was a photographer and he just stopped doing that?
Well, then he was a contractor for the majority of my years, my time with him. You know, when I was a kid, he did that for 20 years. And
like a building contractor?
Mm-hmm. He built buildings, residential buildings for the most part. He had it was called Overall Construction. He likes the puns. Uh-huh. So, and then I started acting and it just that it collected momentum and then it was like a career with, you know, suddenly. And when my so-called life got picked up, we were all shipped out to LA. My brother was in college at this point.
Yeah.
He was at Oberlin. So we moved to LA and we were all so kind of
everybody
deracinated.
Moved?
Well, everybody, my parents and I moved.
For your career?
For the show, yeah. And we moved out, I think, 2 days after that massive earthquake. Was it of 94?
Yeah, 94, 95. I remember
so
that.
So
we
experienced all of those aftershocks. But
welcome.
It was very
welcome
strange, yeah, because everybody was just so spooked and so unnerved and, you know, and we couldn't really identify, but we were experiencing these aftershocks, which were kind of strange, kind of just felt like the subway
yeah.
was rumbling below us.
Exciting.
It was exciting, but it was also too accurate a metaphor for what we were experiencing, you know, just
right.
personally as
yeah,
a,
yeah.
as our family, just being
a big shift.
But my parents moved out here, were kind of didn't know what to do with themselves. It was, My mom was ready to end her school, and my dad's business actually had gone bankrupt like that year. So it was just this really natural.
So they were like, "Thank God, the kid's pulling some money."
Well,
in.
No. But it was a time of transition,
yeah.
very coincidentally,
right?
And but my mom ultimately went back to grad school here in LA. She went to a place called Otis, and
yeah.
my dad started taking photographs. More consistently, and now they live in Santa Monica, and they have two studios in the backyard, and they make their art. You
really?
Know? Yeah, and they show together, and it's like this wonderful, kind of adorable. But that sounds patronizing. I don't mean it. It's great.
Did they give up the place in New York?
They actually own the loft building with
yeah.
another couple. They bought it in the early 70s for like $2.
So now it's like worth millions of dollars.
It's their you know, retirement plan. It's great.
Who lives there? They rent it out?
They rent it out, yeah.
All right, so you're 12.
I'm 12.
Like, how did
Well, I started taking...
My so-called life
Well,
happen.
I danced as a kid.
Do you still dance?
I haven't done it for a while. I danced as a very, very little kid. I took one class with this woman called Ellen Robbins, who was great.
Yeah.
And choreographers from these kind of black box theaters in the Lower East Side
yeah.
would come to her class looking for a young talent. You know, there, occasionally they would need a kid in
their weird shows.
For their weird shows. And
yeah.
I was always like the yeah. hammiest and often the most kind of
uh-huh.
conspicuous and me.
Uh-huh.
And so I got picked a lot. And so I had some experience, you know,
in weird shows?
In the theater.
Uh-huh.
But like,
what kind of weird shows?
Oh, my God.
Like, were you a punchline? Like, here's the kid?
Oh, I actually looked at a video of one of these things that I did when I was maybe 7.
Yeah.
And I never knew what the plot was, because
no.
I don't think there often was a plot.
Yeah, they don't know.
They didn't know. But no, I mean, I looked at it again, I don't know how, I mean, as a grown-up, I guess, and I realized that there was this whole, like, incest theme and you know but I, it was completely lost on me but
they're,
you know
they were so, banking on that
yeah
the,
so
the
there's
kid's
a
not
couple
gonna know.
And then the guy is mm-hmm. like writhing on me and I'm like oh that's what that was they had no
yeah.
clue
yeah.
But and there'd be like maybe 15 people in an audience on a good night.
It's a sexual abuse dance.
Yeah.
Ah.
But no, my first performance was, I don't know, maybe I was 6 at this place called PS-122, and I was a duck.
I've been there.
And I quacked.
Ah.
And there were people on stilts walking around me, a bearded lady, you know, it was that
bearded
kind of
lady
thing.
Stilts, and you were a duck.
Yeah. But I actually, I danced again in, when PS1, I was like 24,
yeah.
maybe?
Because yeah.
I... my best friend, who's now a therapist
yeah.
Her mom is a choreographer. She's actually the reason I started acting,
yeah.
really.
Her mom.
Yeah, kind of. Her mom is a choreographer, and when Ariel, my bestie, had done a student film. I don't know how that happened, but that same director was looking for another kid for his next student film, which was kind of like an elevated student film because he was under the tutelage of Milos Forman, and so his best students were then doing this.
Milos Forman was running a school of some
kind? I guess maybe he was. It was involved. It was
part of a college,
part of Columbia University. Okay. So maybe he was affiliated with Columbia University. But I remember my first audition was with Milos Forman for this dinky little like student film that I got from my best friend's mom. So
what was that role?
I played a girl, an abused girl. Yeah, also an incest theme. So that was my milieu now, back then.
So do you remember how they asked you to play something like, I mean, you were, what, 12, 11?
I was 11.
Because you must have exuded the same type of emotional rawness that you seemed to be very good at at that age. And they were like, that kid looks like she's in trouble.
Yeah, I guess my parents were concerned.
They were?
Yeah, and they asked me, you know, if I was up to I was capable of taking that on.
You've been through a lot.
I said, you know, I guess my answer was like, well, I know what's my imagination and what isn't, and I know the difference between the real and the unreal.
Did they ask you like, are you comfortable?
Yeah, I think they did. I think it was, and I was. I was so, I loved the experience so much.
And you were
so
like, there's no nudity. I think it's okay.
Yeah, there was no nudity. That's
of course
true.
Not.
But years later, in my 20s, Ariel was still, she was dancing and in studying to be a therapist. And ultimately, she had to choose one or the other. But she was still dancing at this point. And I saw her perform and something. And I just was so kind of envious, you know, filled with this desire to do that myself. And she admitted that, you know, she happened to mention that to her mom, Tamar. And so Tamar then called me and suggested that we start kind of working together, dancing just for fun, for the sake of it. And then we did that over the course of a year, and it developed into a solo, an hour-long solo show, which I then performed at PS 122, which was really, really great, actually, to return to
the duck. The duck debacle.
To return to the duck.
To where that happened.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great space, though, PS 122.
It is, yeah.
It's like, I don't talk to that many people who grow up in Manhattan. It's like such a rare thing, and it's such an amazingly unique childhood. Like, you don't have to, like, the rules are completely different, it seems.
I guess so. I mean, when I was a kid, you had to legally prove that you were an artist to live in Soho. It was law.
Is that true?
Yeah.
I kind of like that.
And I mean, people lied, but that, yeah.
Well, what was going on in the house? Like, because I know I talked to Lane about it, and then that's in recent memory, but I don't know that many people that grew up in New York.
Yeah.
And this is like, what, the 70s?
Yeah. Well, so, in the 80s. I was born in 79.
What was it? Were your parents open-minded people?
Yes.
And so you kind of had that whole world available to you.
Yeah.
I imagine they were encouraging, but
But nobody in my family had any interest in the performing arts. I mean, that was completely nobody was prepared for that.
What's your brother do?
My brother's a lawyer.
Huh.
Yeah, he's 6.5 years older. He's in New York. He just got married about a month ago.
He's a regular lawyer.
He's a yep.
Got
he's
a wife.
He's in litigation. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, so you do the thing. You do the abused.
I do the abused thing. Yeah. I had taken classes. I took the first thing I did was take classes when I was 10.
With
at
who?
Lee Strasberg.
You went to Strasberg?
I went to Strasberg.
They had a kids.
Yeah, but most of the kids there, it was like either that or tennis on a Saturday. And
so it wasn't like you weren't sitting around doing Meisner with other
10-year-olds? Well, we were, but I was taking it so seriously, you know, very earnestly trying to feel that wind. And that
you were?
Was not, nobody else
is
was.
Is there a video of that?
Oh, God. I never did feel it, though. But
it
was
fun. You were very serious?
Oh, my God.
That must have been hilarious.
Oh, my God. Was I serious? So I took classes at Lee Strasberg. Yeah.
Was he there? No. No, he's not. Was
no,
he alive?
No, no,
no.
That was, no. He wasn't teaching the 10-year-olds anyway. and then I went to a junior high school for, it was called Professional Performing Arts School.
The Fame School?
Well, it was a derivative of, it was actually, I went in its first year of existence and had a great time. And actually there I met other kids who were professional actors, and I kind of figured out what an agent was. Well, Alicia Keys went to my school, but who else went to my school? Gabby Hoffman, who's still a best friend of mine, went there.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people did. But there was also PCS. That was private. My school was public.
Right.
But that was great because, I got to kind of figure out how one went about getting a real career, like how to get a headshot.
And you went at 13?
I was 11. I was 11.
And you're learning that.
I was learning that. And I did like a cluster of student films.
Yeah.
And my dad had been a photographer. So in our loft, we had a dark room that he rented out. So a woman who was using it then took my headshots, and we sent them out to agents, you know. Somebody actually called back. And then I had this footage. I had these movies, this movie in particular to show.
Where you were the abused kid?
I was the abused kid. It was called Dreams of Love.
Do you still have a copy of it?
I do.
And how's it like? What's it like looking at that now?
Well, I mean, it is a student film in every way. But there's something
Can you see?
I have improved since then.
But can you see yourself in it?
Isn't
it weird to watch stuff like from that long ago, and you're like, I'm me. I'm still me.
Yeah, yeah. And then you have a kid.
You have a kid.
Yes, I have a 16-month-old.
Really?
Baby. Mm-hmm. Cyrus.
A boy.
A boy.
What's that? What? I don't have one of those.
It's pretty intense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
Is it great?
It's so great. People assail you with advice when you're pregnant.
Yeah. And, like what?
Oh, God. I mean, I've...
Don't eat this, don't eat that.
Yeah. And there's some of it's helpful. Some of it is the opposite of that. But somebody said, it's harder and than you can be prepared for and more beautiful than you can be prepared for. It's
And that's turning out to be true for you?
Yeah. Yeah. It's very involving.
Uh-huh.
It's very consuming.
Uh-huh.
And so it does reorient you.
Where's the kid now?
He's at the Sunset Towers.
Oh, your husband's here?
My husband is working. No, he's being babysat right now.
What's your husband do?
He's an actor. His name is Hugh Dancy.
How come? He's an English actor.
He's an Englishman.
And now I want to look at him. What's he been in?
Right now he's on a show called Hannibal. He just wrapped season.
Was he a regular on that?
Yeah, he's like the guy who's hunting Hannibal down.
So you're married to an actor.
I'm married to an actor.
And you're an actor.
And I'm an actor. That happened.
What is
we
that?
We met on a movie called Evening. But I don't know. He's not a very actorly actor. There are some actors who reek of actor.
But is it like we're both doing well right now?
Yeah, we're both doing well, and actually, we're so lucky at the moment because we're in a good, it's a good system. We basically work in tandem. So Homeland films from June to November, and his show films from August to April.
Did you do that contractually? Did you demand that?
No, I mean mostly serendipity, but we kind of. We're conscious of how this might be a good thing, and you know,
there's a big gap we have to fill here. So now you're going to this performing arts high school,
junior high.
You've been taught that it's a cutthroat business that you have to be aware of, and you have to have headshots, and you got to get an agent.
Yeah,
they're laying this all on you. So it's really a professional school like that. It's not a dream school. It's like we're teaching you guys how to be professional.
Yeah, really.
So you get your headshot, and then you send your little movie out.
Send my headshot. I have the movie to show to agents who actually responded.
How'd you decide on the agents? Were your parents involved in your career at that point?
Yeah, but we were all so naive and
no idea what was coming, what was going to happen.
We were just figuring it out as we went along. A woman called Karen Friedman from Writers and Artists signed me, and she was great.
Yeah.
And I started going auditions and like working.
Yeah.
So of course,
what was
your
first gigs?
My first gig was a pilot called Dudley with Dudley Moore that we shot at Silver Cup Studios in Astoria.
Oh, I still live right there.
It was like a real sitcom,
How was working with Dudley at 12 or 13?
Well, I didn't really have a sense of who he was, but he was very charming.
Yeah.
Probably very drunk. Uh-huh. He wore lifts. He played.
He's a little guy.
He had a grand piano in his dressing room. It was like exactly how you would imagine Dudley Moore to be.
So he's like the Arthur character.
Yeah.
So he was out coming off the success of that movie, I imagine.
Yeah. But it was, yeah. This was when I always was very concerned with like playing the truth, you know.
At 13.
Yeah, always.
Why, well, who were your heroes? What was your precedent for that? What was your romantic idea of what acting was?
Meryl.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I remember seeing Accidental Tourist when I was like, I don't know. When did that come out? I was little.
That was who was in that?
William Hurt and Gina Davis.
Gina Davis. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
Hurt was so fucking intense.
Yeah.
He was great.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to watch that again. I don't really remember anything about the movie, but I remember it kind of being...
It was a pretty heavy movie, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, that really affected me when I was a kid. Right. And I saw Sophie's Choice when I was 9.
Oh, my God.
And I just thought, wow,
that's
right.
Crazy.
Okay, so like they can be this. And I didn't even like cartoons as a little girl. I remember getting into a fight with one of my...
You were intense.
I was intense. I just didn't... It didn't appeal to me. I was much more interested in like live action.
Yeah.
And I remember schooling my friend Aria, who really loved Disney movies. And I was like, they're based on Grimm's fairy tales and they're totally abstracted, you know.
Abstracted.
Whitewashed. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, I didn't use these words, but it was basically that
they didn't
attitude.
Even really show the darkness that was in
And
those
I loved
fairy
Grimm's fairy tales. Yeah. Like, I loved Bluebeard and I love, you know, Shelley Duvall had this like fairy tale theater, or she hosted this series of fairy tale theater, and they were much kind of darker, racier. So even that was always my sensibility. But when I did Dudley, I didn't really understand that there were different genres and different styles of acting.
Right, sure.
So I was giving this incredibly earnest performance.
A method performance.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was not appropriate. Not appropriate. But...
did anyone guide you? Say like, hey, kid, lighten up.
Oh, God.
Lighten up a little.
No, they didn't. And they should have. But I think it never got to that point because it was a non-starter, so.
Oh, boy.
But that was my first gig. And then I had a guest spot on Law & Order. I played a teenage murderer that's like every New Yorker's first job.
Yeah.
And then kind of I did a couple of TV movies of the week.
Yeah.
And then I got...
But you were working.
Working consistently, yeah. And I actually kind of made a chunk of change. So I sent myself to private school, which I hadn't been... You know, so I went to Dalton, which was, you know, really...
For high school?
For high school. And then halfway through my freshman year, after my so-called life had initially not got picked up, it then did get picked up. And so I was...
And that's where you could really, like, your emotional capacity and your desire to do something heavy was... You could do it. You could act the way you wanted to act.
I could do it. But also, at that point, I had been through junior high school. I had had some difficulty socially. And so I was full of resentment and rage.
Really? What was difficult for Claire Danes?
Well, girls are not fun.
So what did you
10
do?
To 13.
Did you kick some ass? Did you? What happened?
I had had, every time I had difficulty, there was like one girl who just kept being reincarnated. And my mom's strategy for like response to my struggle was to just put me in a new environment. But that was counterproductive because I'd be like the new girl. And that rendered me vulnerable by definition. And
right.
So boys have a crush on the new girl because they're new, and then girls hate the girl that boys have a crush on.
So what was this girl, this recurring character?
Well, I won't name names, but...
Are you still mad?
Yeah.
You are?
And actually, Morena, who was on Homeland, sadly, not really... I don't think there'll be much opportunity for her to work on this next season because... Oh, spoiler alert, but whatever.
Yeah.
She plays Brody's wife.
Right.
And the first, well, she
yeah,
plays
she's
Brody's
great.
Wife.
Yeah.
We went to junior high school together. We went to the lab school, totally coincidentally,
really?
Not a performing arts junior high school.
Yeah.
And we realized when we met again as grown-ups that we had both been persecuted by this same girl. And we spent many, many hours just still working it out.
Really?
Just,
even now?
Yeah.
What, she was a bully or what?
Yeah, she was a bully.
And what did she do?
Oh, she was just generally undermining, but, you know, would like throw shit at you and call you names and stuff. But the worst thing that girls do is galvanize everybody in the school to hate you.
That's awful.
They recruit.
And you were the hated one?
I was the hated one. Not all the time. I had a very erratic career in school. Sometimes I was doing very well and other times really not so well.
What do you think made you the hated one? Why were you prone to that?
Because...
You're wearing your heart on your sleeve?
A little bit.
The intense girl?
Yeah, like I just really liked learning in school. I really did. I really did. And so my friend Arielle, whom I've known since I was nine, we went to school together. Yeah. We went to junior high to go out there. And she had a whole system. She would only allow herself to answer three questions per class.
Socially or?
No, like, she just never made it obvious. Like, she never
didn't try too hard.
Admitted to her engagement or enthusiasm.
You're the I know girl.
Oh, I was so involved. I just didn't
It's making me sad.
I didn't like
just that you're all wide open and like I want to be right.
And it was really really not a good idea to be. I mean, it was really painful to have that experience. And when I was going to that junior high school of performing arts, because we had
you're like bully food
acting That's class that they tacked on to the end of school, you know, class. So it would be 2 hours of standing there doing exercises and just people saying horrible things.
And you're really working it, so you're like open and want to be emotional. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was it was bad. So by the time I got to my so-called life, I was ready to let him have it.
But have you Facebooked the bully? Have you done any?
No.
But come on, be honest. Have you?
No, I haven't. I don't do Facebook. I do Instagram, but
research in trying to figure out what happened? Just for the satisfaction. Be honest.
I haven't really. Okay. I haven't.
So you've let it go.
I let it go. Uh-huh. I guess. Yeah. It wasn't even them specifically. It was them for a little while. But no, it was just the general system. The whole social structure I found very frustrating. And it was really good for me to go to college finally because I realized that because kids kind of remained at that point developmentally in my imagination because I didn't go through high school where people kind of gradually become
where you see everybody sort of
more humane
or whatever.
So by the time in college, I was people kind of get they get better
sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was also at Yale where people were
the nerds.
The right company.
That's what Yale's filled with. Like, I know, me.
The ooh-ooh-oohs.
Ooh-ooh-oohs. Good. Is that the first time you've put it that way?
Yeah. Oh, in England, they're called SWATs.
Oh, right.
I don't really know why. But.
All right, so but all the success. So you do My So-Called Life, and it's like a cultural phenomenon. I was a little old for it, but I definitely remember watching it and seeing it. But like my buddy who I work with, he's like, you know, that was like the most important show for any of us. So it was huge. So
it was
now
big.
You're.
But it wasn't. It got canceled in its first season. There were only 19 episodes out of 22. But then it got picked up by MTV and then other cable
networks. That's all that was made? Only 19?
Only 19 episodes.
Wild.
But it just kind of had this amazing afterlife. Yeah. So.
Now, have you found. Like, I would imagine that it's the type of show where there was gratitude coming at you from teenagers.
I guess so. But I was still in high school, you know.
So
But in such a weird way. Yeah. In L.A., no high schools were really interested in taking kid actors because there are so many of them here.
Right,
and they know how disruptive they are. So there was only one school, Lycée Français, that would be willing to take me and my very difficult schedule on. And it was kind of a weird place, but I barely went. I was kind of tutored from that point on.
So you're like you're freakish in that you don't have this. You're performing, you're acting out this high school experience, and you don't have any of it.
And I don't have any of it. No. But I mean, I had a semester at Dalton.
Yeah.
And I had, you know, I could riff.
But how did you have a social life? How did you have a love life in high school when you were this isolated?
I didn't.
No.
I didn't. I had a boyfriend when I was, I guess, 15 through a friend. I don't know. Who's lovely. But yeah. No, that's why it was really good for me to go to college.
But what was that decision? I mean, you made some money. You were doing good. You did, before you went to college, what you made a movie or two, too, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. No,
like, I remember being surprised. Like, there was, like, this moment. And I kind of, I don't know why I remember it. But in my mind, you had everything going on and everything was going the way it was
supposed
to go.
Well, I'd always wanted to go to college. And at that point, too, I'd been working so relentlessly and I was a little maxed out. I was a little, and it was confusing because I had, yeah, a lot of success very yeah. quickly, but I kind of didn't know how to harness it or focus it. I didn't know what to do with it.
Right.
I didn't have like a little culture, you right. know, I needed time to create that and right. I needed the space to create that. You know, safely.
Culture, what do you mean?
Like, I didn't know what movies I wanted to see, never mind what movies I wanted to make. I didn't know what my value system, I had no life. Yeah, I had no aesthetic.
Right.
Like, I really needed to just take a second to
figure out who you were.
Figure that out, yeah. And actually, I deferred a year after I filmed, and I had a boyfriend at the time who was a musician, and I went yeah. on tour with him.
What band?
He's called Ben Lee. He's Australian.
You really. Toured with a musician boyfriend.
Yeah, did that for a long time. Stayed in a lot of like Motel Sixes and ate at Denny's.
Was that a good relationship?
Yeah, we were together for 7 years.
7 years with mm-hmm. a musician.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so you go aestheticless, valueless
songs,
to Yale.
Yeah.
To what a rough school too, right? I mean,
yeah. Well, actually, my grandfather had been dean of the art and architecture department at Yale.
So you
and
had
my
an
dad
in. You
grew,
had an in?
My dad grew up in New Haven, but I always kind of had wanted to go to Yale because I had this, I don't know, sense
Meryl
of...
Meryl Streep thing? Didn't she go there?
She did, but she went to the acting program. I just went to undergrad.
It's kind of nice up there. It's weird. It's like a beautiful old school, but the surrounding area, not great, right?
Yeah, there's tension between...
the locals and
the townies
and the
ooh-ooh-oohs.
Yeah,
and the ooh-ooh-oohs.
Yeah.
But I, yeah, as I was, I thought that I would be able to make a movie in the summer, every summer, and I kind of failed to realize how much work goes into getting work. And I was, school was just way too.
Did you
like,
think you were in
demanding?
Like you could
at
just call your shots.
I don't know. It just was not. Not realistic.
All right, so you go to this,
I had to choose one or the other, ultimately.
So you go to the beautiful Ivy League school, and you decide you're going to study what?
I was going to be a psychology major, I thought, so I took a lot of psychology classes, but that involved a lot more lab work than I had anticipated.
Yeah.
It's not what I meant.
Uh-huh. That's not what you thought? I just want to be able to sit and talk to people and help them.
Yeah, no, basically I thought that studying therapy would just be, would translate into like, receiving therapy.
Uh-huh.
I don't know, because that had been my experience with therapy.
Uh-huh.
On the couch, and I don't know.
When did you start therapy?
Oh,
when
God. Like, I'm a New Yorker.
Right.
Six or something?
So you had to do that. Well, what was your problem, Claire?
Well, at six, I saw ghosts and things. It was a little OCD. And I went a couple times, and then...
To the weird child shrink?
No, to my parents' therapist, Gideon.
Oh, yeah. So you went to Gideon.
I went to Gideon.
I'm seeing ghosts, and I like
yeah.
to wash my hands. What was it?
Yeah, I was starting to really, like, it was getting to disrupt my daily life. Like,
what,
demons were coming out of the shower heads. And
really? You were hallucinating?
No, but I didn't, but, and there was, like, a gargoyle on the pipes in ceiling of our loft, and it would make me do things like assume contorted positions for half an hour or something.
The gargoyle made you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And what did Gideon say about
Gideon
this?
Gideon said, well, can you anticipate the appearance of the gargoyle? You know,
mm-hmm.
basically, are you creating this creature in your head? And I had to admit that, yes, I was. And he said, okay, well, then you have the power to... let them go, you know.
And did you?
Yeah. And basically, once I was in therapy at six, I was like, oh, this is a problem. I have a problem. And once you realize that you have a problem, it kind of is punctured,
right?
I find.
Well, that was just a gargoyle problem. What
was
the next problem?
That was a gargoyle problem. Oh, well, then the next problem was just being a teenager, which uh-huh. is a terrible problem.
And you, yeah.
I haven't been in therapy for a while.
Okay. So you're all better?
No, I just have a kid now and don't have any time.
Well, I think,
and also I'm in sort of perpetual motion, which makes it
when you're busy.
Tough. Yeah.
But okay, so you go for 2 years, and did you? Was there panic? Like, I'm going, my career's going to go away. You know, there must have been some sort of crisis to just drop
in
out
college?
Of Yale.
Oh no, I was really, really glad to not be working. I was so excited to be at. I really loved it.
Did
it
you find your aesthetic
hard.
And your values?
I did. I did call it jail every so often because uh-huh. it was really intense.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, finally, my kind of desire to act again came. Back.
And did you start studying again, or did you were,
well it was
or did you already feel set? Like, I never understand, actors can never explain it, because I tend to think that a lot of acting is a natural ability. So like when you, and you're very good at it, so when you leave Yale and you'd already done the work you'd done, did you feel like you needed to train more, or did you?
Well, it was an awkward period after school
because you're grown
in terms
up
of
now.
My acting, because actually I hadn't done it for 3 years.
Yeah.
I was very unsure of myself, and I started to approach roles like I would an essay or something, uh-huh. you know, from this academic standpoint, and because that had been my habit. So,
what do you mean?
Well, I started to just analyze the character in a
right.
very heady way.
Well,
you know,
you're
kind
clearly
of,
a heady person.
But no, not only that. But I had to remember that it's basically an intuitive, physical,
right.
visceral.
So you're trying
exercise.
To deconstruct it.
Yeah, I mean, you do. It does require some analysis in the beginning, and with some roles in particular, you have to research more intensely than others. And
was that always part of your process? Or is it just something
well,
intuitive?
Well, I mean, it seems obvious. Like,
right.
you know, I
might as well get to know
like
the
with
person.
Romeo and Juliet, when I was a kid, I had to kind of figure out what iambic pentameter was, you know. So I read a book on that and, you know.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. There was a time when I was reading everything in iambic pentameter.
Well, how close was that? Well, he didn't do the whole play, did he? The Romeo and Juliet you were in. But it was still in that language. It was still all the same.
All the same language.
Yeah. That was a pretty exciting movie,
That
right?
was so fun. I was 16.
And Leonardo?
Yeah.
Ah.
In Mexico City. All those crazy boys.
What was he, when you worked with him then, did you feel that he was destined for greatness?
He was already a really big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he did Titanic, and then he was like a really
And you were up
big
for that
deal.
Role?
Yeah. I don't know. I didn't want to do it. I
Good
I
choice,
just, Yeah, right? Yeah. Well, but I'd just done this, like, literally just finished filming this romantic epic with Leo in Mexico, where they filmed Titanic, and it just seemed a little redundant at that point. Like,
but the industry was probably like, perfect. They're already working together.
Yeah,
kids
I guess so.
Love them.
But it was years. I'm going to spend the bulk of my life,
with
my
Leonardo
teeny tiny DiCaprio. Life with Leo. You know, I love him. He's great. But like, I wanted to have some other experiences.
What was the first role you took after college? Do you want me
I
to
guess
look?
It was The Hours and maybe Igby Goes Down.
The Hours. So that's with Meryl Streep.
Yeah, it was a tiny role. But
you got to be with her.
Yeah, I totally got to be with her.
Were you nervous?
Yeah. And so excited.
Because she was it, right?
She's a bit ooh-ooh-y too, though.
Yeah?
She's a little ooh-ooh-y.
Yeah. You can tell. Yeah.
But she's also kind of naughty too.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
She seems like a troublemaker a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
But she's such a wizard, man.
Oh, she's absurd. She's obscene.
So how old are you? So you're what, 20, 19?
Yeah, I guess I was 20.
And you get like before, so you get cast in this thing as her daughter, right?
Yeah.
And you must have been like, what the fuck?
Yeah, a little bit. Rehearsing with her was very out of body. And at one point, she struggling with something. She said, you know, you can be bigger. You can be bigger. You can do more. No, it was like, it was amazing advice to come from that lady.
Yeah.
Like Oz, you know.
And do you have a relationship with Meryl Streep?
Yeah. Well, now she's Mamie's mom, which is kind of odd. But she's also, you know, the best actor ever.
Yeah.
Still.
She is, right?
Yeah.
It's It's pretty wild.
I think so.
Yeah, I do too.
And I take it personally. I get verklempt when people, like, you know, criticize her for being too, I don't know.
Too what?
Perfect, ornate, yeah. Or, you know, people will accuse her of being kind of studied or affected, or I don't know.
But she's
just, I think she's incredible.
Do you have any idea what, it's a natural gift, right?
It's a natural gift, and she's also just done it. So, I mean, her appetite is still so voracious. I mean, she's always working.
What else did you learn from her other than you can be bigger?
You can be bigger. Oh, choose your battles, you know. Yeah. Be strategic about when you complain.
But as an actor, when you worked with her in terms of generosity.
Well, you know what was really interesting was that I saw the effort in her practice, you know, like she's not a unicorn. She's not a magical creature who, you know, is, you know, just a pure vessel.
Right.
She toils. Yeah. She wrestles with the thing, the idea, the experience. And she, you know, if she's playing an upsetting scene, she's upset, you know, it's taxing.
And
that was also good to see that it's a messy process and it's scary for even the most
well-trained and best
virtuosic
actress.
yeah
you can't, like, if you're working from that place,
you're working and it's hard and it's embarrassing and you can't bother to worry about that. Like, you can't
embarrassing
well like you have to kind of make some noise. You have to really be vulnerable, and that can betray things that you might not want people to see necessarily.
Sounds,
but kind of too bad
moments.
Yeah.
Well, so, you certainly do that in spades on Homeland.
It's so fun to have license to do that.
Is it?
Yeah, that's great. I mean,
but I mean, there has to be some learning curve as to
you can't
comfort.
Just kind of go. Rah! You have to have an idea of.
But you have to also allow yourself to do it, even in character. I would imagine that that has to have been from acting as much as you have, to have the comfort to let that part of you out.
Yeah, and you also have to have a design. You know, you have to have a So like with Temple Grandin, for example, that was really
great.
Fun.
That was great. I didn't know who that person was.
She's so cool. She's so interesting.
Yeah.
But
I watched that movie. I'm like, not only was I learning, but I was like, oh my God, Claire Danes is so good.
Thanks. That was really great training for me to think about who this manic depressive person would be, or bipolar is the term now. But I actually think manic depressive is sort of more apt.
Well, yeah. Well, Temple Grandin, who is alive and you spent time with.
Yeah.
And that emotional profile must have been incredibly challenging, but you made it very accessible. And I imagine, you know, given what her particular problem was, how hard was it really to get there once you kind of figured it out?
Well, actually, I worked with my friend Tamar, this choreographer that I had mentioned, because she's just so smart about how bodies work. So we met with a lot of autistic teenage girls specifically, and just tried to make sense of how it affects their physicality.
Right.
And we kind of broke it down. And I don't usually do that. I usually recruit help in that way. But for this, it was actually really valuable. But, you know, so a lot of autistic people have what's called stims. They self-stimulate.
Sure.
So actually, my husband, Hugh, had played an autistic character in a movie called Adam about 6 months prior to this. So that was very handy. He had done the research, you know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Our shelves were already stacked with the necessary, you know, the required reading. So I had to kind of, everybody has their own particular set of stems.
But they're steady. They're consistent.
They're consistent to them.
They
yes.
choose. It's how they feel order, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. Or comfort themselves.
Right. So it was fun to turn to Hugh and be like, what were your stims? How did you do your panic attacks? But Temple had a very clear set. And she was amazing to work with because autistic people are often very guileless and they don't really have shame.
Right.
And so she, and she also is an example, a wonderful model for so many people in the autistic community. So she, She's a scientist, so she would divulge anything I wanted to know, you know.
And but were you able to sort of draw from her, obviously, from her physicalities as well?
Yeah.
She still has them.
She still has them. And, yeah. you know, she has a very wide stride. And she said, because I have no sense of balance. And, you know, but again, no. Yeah, she's very funny. She had a great sense of humor. I spent a day with her, and she said that, I guess, when she heard that I was doing the movie, of course she researched me online, and she did was research sort of on like, you, oh god, how is this blonde girl gonna play me? And she said people said some really mean stuff, like, I don't think Claire Danes can play a retard. Which is so offensive to both of us. But she howled, she thought it was hysterical. It was.
That's amazing.
But, yeah. So I had to be really clear about what her stims were, and, you know, she always had her sort of chin down because she was in her own world and didn't feel the desire to engage or empathize with whomever she was talking to. And, you know, so her spine was kind of tight, and she did have, you know, she did have this wide stride, and so collectively, you know, you have this whole dance.
And how? Yeah. So you saw it as a series of movements. And,
yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where the choreographer helped out.
Yes.
Because that's sort of an interesting approach, isn't it? I mean, I guess people do have movement coaches.
Yeah.
But to actually think of it as
was a vital part of her character for sure, and then that also. I that was true for Carrie too, in her manic stages, manic phases.
Uh-huh.
Of course it affects the body, and but I love to dance, so that's so fun for me too.
So connecting the body is not a big issue for you?
No, I love it. That's so interesting to me.
Because I get in my head, you know, I haven't done a lot of acting, but I've done a little.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like sort of like, what are my hands doing?
Right. Yes. Wait,
it's weird, though. Like, some people, I imagine when you act enough, you're not sitting there going, like, should I scratch my face?
Yeah. I remember I heard Meryl talk about her role. Was it in Ironweed? Is that right?
Oh, yeah. That was great.
Oh, God. So good. But what is it a clef symbol? Is that the musical symbol?
Yeah,
she said she imagined her character as that kind of. I just thought that was so beautiful. But that's often all you need. Like, it takes a lot of work to find that iconic image that you know, is so useful that the whole performance kind of hangs off of.
Yeah.
But that's a good example of how an actor might think about.
Right. I just talked to another actor. Who was it? Who pictured himself a fortress.
Mm-hmm.
Like a building.
Yes. Yeah.
Like he thought of a building.
Mm-hmm.
That's
that makes
crazy.
Sense.
Yes, it does. It's probably easier than, who was it? Jared Harris.
Mm. He's so good.
He's so good.
So good.
But like, you know, we were talking about animal work and this and that, but the idea that a clef or a building is actually easier than like thinking of an animal or a person, because it becomes a metaphor.
Right.
That you build on.
But I think she probably, you know, riffed on that literally. I bet she did kind of slope in that way, like,
yeah.
You know, hanging off the bar and stuff.
And this, the Homeland role, like, it's all fresh in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up with some mental illness in my family. Mm-hmm. So you play it manic depressive.
Yeah.
Mania is the propulsion.
Well, she's more manic than depressive because it's a TV show. And it's a lot more interesting.
Right.
Watching somebody in manic state than
as opposed to someone sitting.
Mm-hmm. For many, many weeks in a row.
Do you have any mental illness that you were drawing from in your family or in yourself?
No, I mean, I think some depression runs in our family, but yeah. No.
Because you're pretty wide open in that performance. Like, I'm starting to put it together, you know, with Temple and with the character on Homeland and some of your other stuff. Is that you, emotionally, you're pretty open, it seems, in character.
I try.
How'd you put that character together? It's not a real person.
That's not a real person, and I mean, there's a lot of license that we're taking here, but I had to bone up on CIA culture and
bipolar disorder.
And bipolar disorder. That was a really fun month. But yeah, I went to Langley, and I have a spy big sister who I, you know, a mentor who I continue to call now.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Do you call her with, you know, international policy questions? And...
No, but actually now I'm like a producer, you know, I have this fancy label, but it means that I get to be a little bit more involved in the in the creation of the thing.
Yeah.
And so I was invited to go meet with Spooks for 3 days with the writers, and that was really groovy. But
yeah.
So I met with this woman. I read a lot of books on CIA, and then I met with a woman who's bipolar, Julie Fast. That's quite a last name to for somebody who has that condition.
Yeah.
And she's written a lot of books on it. And ultimately, the best resource for the bipolar stuff was like vlogs on YouTube, because there are a lot of bipolar people who are up in the middle of the night and just need to talk. And so they talk to the camera. And so there's a
culture of bipolar vlogs for other bipolar people, or just for people who want to watch bipolar people talk?
I don't know. They have, I mean, I think it's also a very isolating experience. So I imagine they want to share it. They want to create a community. They should. I think it's helpful.
So you were picking up on the frequency.
Yeah, because I was talking to my friend Arielle, you know, I have a lot of friends who are therapists, so I talked to them about their working with their bipolar patients, and she said, well, you know, just every case is unique, so you can extrapolate pretty easily. Like, there is no norm necessarily, but she said, I've only seen them in agitated manic states, because if they're in a euphoric manic state, they're not coming to therapy. Like, they're not. Yeah. So, because it's one thing to read about the condition, but really I just wanted to see people in action. And the best way to do that was to watch these.
Agitated manic state.
Yeah.
Because your character has it had a euphoric?
She has euphoric when she first becomes manic in the first season, the end of the first season. She's feeling pretty good, because she's feeling like she has all the answers. And then the great conceit of the show is that, in fact, yeah, she does. I mean, which is not true. I mean, the really tragic thing, the very difficult thing about people with this condition is that there's just so much erraticism. I mean, they will have these insights that are truly brilliant, but they can't hold on to them. They can't really develop them.
Because it goes away. The momentum goes away.
Yeah. And it just becomes very disorganized thinking, you know, that clarity gets muddy.
That's why you need a rock like Mandy Patinkin
Magical Mandy. Yeah.
But do you find that, like, you can get yourself into a mania?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you're doing this role, I mean, have you...
I do kind of get a contact high. Yeah,
because you're jacking your dopamine, and
absolutely
just to do it, you have control over that to a degree, but it does lock in.
Yeah, and it's kind of exhausting.
Yeah, after a day of shooting that, does it stay with you? I mean,
I'm actually pretty good now. I think because
now,
well, when I was a kid, I would be in a. I was in an emotional state for the entire day. Yeah, and that was not economical. That was counterproductive, ultimately, because you're wasting your energy.
Got to reel it in.
Because you have to keep it on a simmer.
Yeah.
You know, you can't have it on full blast all the time. You have to reserve the energy.
So you figured that out.
Yeah, over time and, you know, just practice.
But when you do a season doing Carrie, do you... Or anything you do, I mean, have you come out of shoots where you feel overly exposed or ashamed or embarrassed or?
No, because it's not. You know, it's land. It's make believe.
Okay.
It's not me. It's not on me. She, my imaginary friend, did it.
Oh yeah,
she totally did it. I did not. I'm protected. So yeah, that's the great.
Do you meditate or you just run?
You know what? I run. And so many of the people on the show talk about meditating. I think, fuck, I think I got to go. I got to meditate now.
Yeah.
But I think that's my equivalent.
Yeah.
So it's an hour a day where I.
No matter what?
Pretty much no matter what. Because I travel so much, it's just a portable form of
get on the treadmill in the hotel.
Yeah, I tried meditating for a while when I was with my musician boyfriend. We had a dalliance with TM, and
some people dig it.
I know that I think we had kind of a creepy teacher who was, I don't know, just very impressed by fame. And so, I don't know. There was just something a little disingenuous about him. And sure. It kind of turned me off of the thing, which is a shame because, you know.
There are people that will attach themselves to the belly of show business.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
But no, I think probably it would be of value. But gosh.
I know. I'd
rather just run around the block a whole lot.
Yeah, then sit still and try to clear your head.
Yeah.
I'm the same way. I just started running again. It's good.
Yeah, I like it a lot. That's kind of my thing.
So you've won two Emmys for this character.
Yes.
Two. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, that must feel great.
It feels really nice. It feels really nice because I just don't care. Like, I know that it doesn't matter now. I really know that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have that privilege, right, of knowing that it really doesn't matter.
If you really know that, then it's sort of like, nice, okay, thank
you.
Yeah.
I mean, I say that and then, you know, these things are so weird, these award things, because they matter, they do, and then they don't. And it's very hard for me to categorize them.
Yeah.
I equate it with, like, in junior high.
Right.
When, like, some guy would come up to you and say, my friend wants to go out with you.
Yeah.
And you'd say, but I don't know your friend. And he'd say, well, you'll get to know him. So right. Then you start going out with
whoever.
Boy X.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in the way that you go out with boy X in junior high, which is like, don't talk to each other for about a month and then break up.
Right. Yeah. Sit awkwardly next to each other.
Yeah. But over this time of non-communication, I would develop feelings because, you know, that was my job.
Yeah.
I'm a good girl that way. But then they'd break up with me and I'd be like, I didn't even freaking know you.
How dare you?
Now you're breaking up with me. Yeah. So that's kind of what the award thing feels like. You're tapped, you're courted, you got to go find a dress.
Right.
And then you're all involved.
Yeah.
And then it's totally unrelated to the thing that it's apparently about.
Yeah.
And then you like feel like an asshole and loser. You're just like, what? How did that happen?
But you won too.
Yeah, you win them. But I've also not won them. And I've had that experience. And that's like, oh, okay. But
I guess I'll return the dress.
Yeah. Oh, I was nominated for an Emmy for my so-called life, and I had actually won the Golden Globe. I didn't know anything about anything at this point. The Golden Globes, I didn't know what they were.
That must have been a fun night.
It was fun. It was
13-year-old.
I guess I was 15 at that point. And but so by the time the Emmys came around, I was like, well, I won one. Like, maybe I'll win this one. And, I found when I was cleaning my house the other day, I found my like sad little thank you note in my little purse, you know.
Oh, really?
Of my terrible, like too long, way too earnest, you know. And I think all my best friends.
Oh, no. You found the one that you didn't get to give?
Yeah. I guess I was 50. Yeah, 15-year-old acceptance speech.
You're still pretty earnest.
Oh my God, terribly. It's like a family curse.
Oh yeah.
We are so earnest. Yeah, yeah. And I just have to accept it. I can't not. It's really unfortunate.
Is that exhausting?
I don't know.
What do you do for fun? How do you loosen up there, Claire?
Embroider.
That's it. It's running and embroidering.
Kind of.
All right. You're okay with that. That's good.
Yeah. This last year, I got really involved with the embroidery. And my friends are all having babies right now that age. And so I'm away from them. And so I was embroidering like onesies, you know. That was my thing. I would riff on the name, so I'd find the meaning of the name and then find some image that was reflected the meaning of the name. But it got so extreme that like the crew turned my director's chair into like an embroidery station. So they made an arm a pin cushion, and I had a special light. And
so you're kind of obsessive.
I'm a little obsessive, yeah.
And what's gonna happen now?
I'm a little myopic.
Got to keep things in control,
I like the control. Yeah. I like the control, but
feeling that. Yeah.
But I'm also a little disorganized, so it's a little confusing.
That must be difficult.
It's my
that's
burden.
Your struggle.
It's my struggle.
Keeping everything.
I have struggles.
I know it's tough to be a little OCD and a little control freaky, and the world just keeps going, isn't it?
It keeps going.
why can't things just be the way you want them to
the
be?
The exact same all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's real. I think that's my, yeah.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, I have great trouble with transition and change and erraticism. And I am in a reality and in a job that forces that upon me constantly. So I'm working it out.
Well, what, so what, which one of your, was, who was your dad nuts?
My dad had a difficult childhood. Yes. Very difficult.
Yeah.
But he's not nuts.
But I mean, like, somehow growing up, it seems to me that if there's got to be, in order to be kind of the earnest control OCD person, there must have been a little like, oh God.
Well,
or was it just New York?
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of a, my parents were not terribly typical conservative people by any, I mean, it was a little, it was a little chaotic, our living environment, but fine, too.
The artsy thing?
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, we had a trapeze and a trampoline and the dark room and, you know.
Yeah. Weird friends coming over.
Weird friends.
Uh-huh.
And then my mom had the school, so then it was a literal playground.
Huh.
So it was a very imaginative,
right.
You know,
not
creatively fertile environment.
So not a lot of boundaries.
Not a lot of boundaries. Yeah. Not a lot of boundaries.
That'll do it.
But that's okay.
Sure.
I mean, I love my parents. And they gave, I mean, proof's in the pudding. I'm sane and happy and connected and, you know.
Your brother is too.
And my brother is too. So, like, they did great.
Did all right.
They did fine. But I also think it was a generational, like, shift where now, God, the style of parenting is so much. It's so so fastidious, you know.
Yeah, what do you mean?
Well,
I don't have a kid.
Oh,
how's the style change? Like, you got a hypervigilant type
of thing? Yeah, hypervigilant.
And,
I mean,
and negotiating all, like, what, deliberating what's going to ruin the kid, what isn't going to ruin the kid?
Yeah, I mean, corn syrup is like the devil. And that's fair enough. Like, that, no, there's truth in that, absolutely.
Yeah.
And but the kids are so, their lives are so micromanaged. And I was of an era, I mean.
Yeah, go ahead and go out into Washington Square by yourself. You're 10.
Totally.
Yeah,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I was taking the subway alone at 11.
Right. Never 10. Now.
Never.
Never.
Never, never.
I not mean, even, not
they'd
even,
be like jailed, yeah, my parents.
Right.
So yeah, it was looser for sure.
I guess for good reason. I mean, but you know, if you think about New York at that time, it was probably more dangerous.
Much more dangerous. Yeah.
I don't know where that trust came from. I think that, you know, I know some parents and they're paralyzed with fear all the time.
Yeah, which is
at every turn.
You know, yeah. I mean, and it's scary. And every time I put my son down, you know, that's the worst expression. I put him to bed.
Yeah.
Every time I murder him. Yeah. No.
I know, but that's right. He's still young, so you've got the whole ride ahead of you.
Yeah, the whole ride. Yeah, yeah. For sure. But no, there's this baseline of anxiety because it's just too much. Like, you're responsible for this tiny being.
God, what are you going to do when he starts to get a personality?
Oh, it's so hard. he's getting one now.
Uh-huh.
He's like, he's entering terrible two territory.
How's that going for you?
It's okay.
Are you happy you have a boy?
Yeah, I'm happy I have him. Yeah. I think he's great. I'm so lucky because he's been super easy, which is a very, very fortunate thing, because I was pregnant with him while I was filming the second season. And then, you know, when I started the last season, he was 5 months old. And so he's been on this ride with me.
So you're going into season four?
Going into season four, yeah.
He's been there the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Now, literally.
Inside and out.
Inside and out. Yeah.
And what is this charity that you're involved with?
Oh, Afghan Hands?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's a nice thing. I have a good friend who also happens to be my makeup artist, surprisingly, Mateen Malawizada, who's from Afghanistan. And he's been working with these women who are mostly widows, but sort of disenfranchised women in Afghanistan who, when their husbands die, have no agency and no authority and are kind of beholden to their in-laws and are... Yeah, in a very, very bad way. So they have these embroidery skills, and we kind of help them develop those skills. And in exchange for their work, they make these scarves and pillows and stuff that we sell. We give them a bit of money and an education. They're mostly illiterate, and they learn to read and write and just it's kind of teaching man a fish kind of theory.
Right.
And they can create, you know, opportunities to exist in, you know, more comfortably in the world. So.
Do you spend time over there?
I haven't been able. I would love to go, but it's just been too dangerous. So, but I would really like to go. And it's my mom, who was a textile designer, actually designed a line of scarves that they then made. So that's going to be available on the website, afghanhands.org.
Oh.
And it's a really nice idea, you know?
Yeah.
It's like a conversation between us and
cultures
and these other women. And we'd love to go and actually see them and embroider together.
Yeah. There you go. Maybe you can, you know, bring everyone a director's chair.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you really need.
That's the dream. Yes.
A director's chair.
You know, I'm sure you know what a lot of people need, right?
Yeah, clearly. Yeah. Uh-huh.
All right. Well, good luck with the child rearing.
Thank you.
And the new season.
Thank you.
And keeping everything under control.
It's all going to be fine.
Yeah, I feel
it's going to be great.
I feel that, Claire. I really do. All right, that's our show, folks. Thank you for listening. Isn't she lovely? Very earnest. Great conversation. I was very flattered that she wanted to come on the show. I was excited to see her. And it really was actually very exciting for me to talk to Claire Danes. I do want to remind you again that you can go to our website and you can use the Shop on Amazon banner that's on the homepage of WTFpod.com. There's also a banner on Adam Carolla's site. And just go shopping and let's move some of that money to keep this legal defense fund going so we can fight personal audio, because they do not have a patent on podcasting. Anyways, yeah, so this week we have three episodes. On Wednesday, we're going to have the guys who wrote The Humor Code. And on Friday, Pat Healy from the movie Cheap Thrills, which is a very disturbingly great movie. And me and Pat have some history. So that was a great conversation. It's weird. There's moments where I, you know, I forget my life. I forget the history. Some guy who used to live here when I was in New York, Don Kelly, a good friend of mine, his brother just sent me a book. His brother apparently hung out here at the house and took pictures of all the cats around. And he had a book made for me, and it just came in the mail. And you know, it's got pictures of Boomer and Moxie and some of the strays that are no longer around. It was kind of emotional. Boomer was a great cat. Boomer lives!